This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Perfect. Cut. Print it.
Hello and welcome to episode 20 of Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilibus. If you've never listened to this podcast before, what we do around here is we watch every single film in the collective Coppola filmography to determine, are they the greatest film family of all time? On this week's episode, I'm joined by the lovely, fantastic, and downright handsome Matt Brothers to discuss Ed Wood, Tim Burton's 1994 biopic of the lambasted film director, which brings us to our Coppola connection for this week, which we'll get into a bit more in a moment or so, but it is Stephanie Schwartzman, the older sister to both Robert and Jason Schwartzman, as well as John Schwartzman's full sister. She's only half to Jason and Robert, but yeah, she's got an amazing run. Check her out on IMDb. She's got a fantastic run of films that we'll get into, and this is one. Please do be warned that we will be spoiling this film rotten. So if you haven't seen it, please do check out the document in the show notes that will tell you if and where this film is streaming. Just like last week, just spoil it for you right now. It's Disney Plus, guys. I promise I'm not a shill for Disney. It just happens that the Coppolas love that House of Mouse, apparently. If you enjoyed this conversation with Matt and would like a bit more of us chatting all about Nicolas Cage, you can head on over to patreon.com/ Caged In Pod to find a fantastic little kind of, yeah, like the old questions he used to ask, purely Cage based. Is Matt a Nick Cage fan? What was his first and which is his favorite Nick Cage movie? That episode was recorded back in April. This one was recorded a few weeks ago. We get into it in the episode. So I guess all that's left to do is put on an Angora sweater, a friend, an aging Hollywood star, and round up as many people and as much money as you can to make the movie that you want to make, no matter how bad it is, as we make some Coppola connections. The year is 1994. The Lion King is the biggest film, and Forrest Gump has won the Academy Award for Best Picture. But what were the Coppola family up to? Nicolas Cage was in three films, Trapped in Paradise, Guarding Tess, and It Could Happen to You. John Schwartzman was the cinematographer on Airheads, and his sister Stephanie was an assistant to the production designer. Tim Burton's love letter to one of old Hollywood's punchlines. A man who was voted the worst director of all time in 1980 with his comedy drama biopic, Ed Wood. To help me piece together some stock footage, paint some paper plates to look like flying saucers, and maybe even help me pick out an Angora sweater, is Star Trek detective, Paul Dano welfare observer, and one third of your and my favourite trip. Linked by a word in the title podcast, but today, he is the Bela Lugosi to my Ed Wood. Matt Brothers, how are you, Matt?
Hello, sir. I'm well, thanks. Thanks for having me on. How you doing?
I'm very well. I'm excited to re-record this
conversation. Yeah, here we are.
So let's, 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 uh, let's kind of not bury the lead on this and say that there was a massive cock-up in kind of Edward fashion. We tried to get this to work, but we've had to come back for some reshoots.
I think it was back in like April, wasn't it? Because going by my Letterboxd logging for the last time I watched Ed Wood, it was April something. So yeah, a good time has passed. I've basically forgotten what I said. I have some old notes, some new notes. And yeah, I love the idea that you were almost going to do for a while of like Frankensteining together the episode using my original thing and you just filling in your own gaps with little prompts here and there, which would have been like a very Ed Woodian way of getting the episode out for sure.
That may still happen. That would be a real labor of time and love and kind of care and attention to really make it sound as stilted and like horrible as possible. And it is that thing of, it sounds like a great idea on paper, but it's like when people listen to it, they go, what the fuck is this?
I think bullshit? Ironically, the quickest way around it was just to do it again. So here we are.
Yeah, definitely. So obviously, yeah, we're here to talk about a film that is about a director who was nominated the worst director of all time. So I kind of wanted to open up the conversation by kind of talking about that phenomenon of worst directors and worst films and kind of get your opinion on that kind of phenomenon.
Yeah, it's funny, like it does feel like Ed Wood was kind of the first to kind of have that mantle, at least within sort of cult film circles. And it's interesting that you say that he was only voted that in 1980. You know, I say only voted, which was a couple of years after his death, wasn't it? But I think it felt like the video, you know, the VHS wave and the 80s film scene kind of brought in more fans and more people discovering bad movies. And it feels like Ed Wood kind of had that title for a while. And then I think as you head into the 80s and 90s, I think there's so much more sort of schlock and B-movie stuff still being made. So I think there's going to be lots more contenders out there that maybe not many people have heard of. And then recently, I guess the big one, the sort of new Ed Wood, would be someone like Tommy Wiseau with The Room, which has taken off in a very similar way to Plan 9. But yeah, like it's hard to think because you know, on paper it should be. If you're a bad director, you wouldn't get work. But obviously that's not the case. You can't keep some of these guys down.
Yeah, I find it very fascinating, this kind of idea of, I don't know, we kind of live in an age where it's fun to ironically like bad movies. Obviously The Room is a prime example, kind of get screenings around the world that have, and it's retroactively become like this. Oh no, it's always meant to have been a comedy and like this audience participation and stuff like that. And I know that, it might be a while ago now that you guys on Sudden Double Deep looked at Troll 2, and the best worst movie, the director.
Yeah. I was gonna say out of the ones kind of on the list, Troll 2 is up there in one that does kind of transcend the bad movie, because you know, make no mistake, it's a bad film, but so much of it magically falls into place and is calibrated in a way that it is highly enjoyable. Like I think the truly bad films are the ones that are just not fun to watch in any way, or you know, it's a mix of poor craftsmanship, poor story, poor script, poor everything, plus like I can't even make fun of it. Whereas Troll 2, even more so than The Room, in my opinion, because it does kind of tell a more ambitious genre story, but is just hilariously misguided. And that film, coupled with that excellent doc, Best Worst Movie, kind of covers it really well. And I'm quite excited because coming up on Sun Double Deep, a few weeks from recording today, we'll be looking at another one of that director, Claudio Fragasso's films, Monster Dog, in an upcoming dog triple bill, which was, like a monster dog horror film from the mid-80s, I think he did. So I'm very looking forward to seeing if it's worse than Troll 2.
I kind of accidentally did some, like, prep for this film. And last night I watched Frank Henenlotter's Brain Damage. And I've got the Arrow Blu-ray, so I was watching some of the, like, special features. And there's, like, just in the way of how, like, he just got this ramshackle crew together to make kind of these B movies and how they did it on like such a low budget and stuff like that. And it kind of like, I think he's somebody who kind of, I don't know, without an Ed Wood, you wouldn't have got the kind of Frank Henenlotters and that, those kind of directors from the 80s, right?
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I think the truly, you know, worst films out there are the ones that try to be bad on purpose because, you know, you have that disconnect there and it just becomes extra cynical. It's like, you know, you're trying to make a good bad movie on purpose, you know, to make some money. And like, you know, all these truly bad films wanted to make money on the merits of being a good film. And whether it was just circumstance or talent or lack of talent or people involved or whatever it is, because, you know, a million things can go wrong when making a film, they turn out bad. But as we see in Ed Wood, you know, it's a truly bad film, hopefully, is one that the director intends to be good. No one sets out to make a bad film, as they say. And the ones that, do try and just pastiche something or tick boxes or try and do something based on, you know, whether it's Twitter algorithms or memes or trying to hit a certain zeitgeisty thing or anything like Asylum-type films, which are very obviously cheap versions of other films. They're the ones that try and, out of the gate, make it wink, wink, bad. And I think you can't really sit and enjoy those in the same way because we're all in on the same joke. And if we're all in on it, it stops being a joke, I guess. It's a weird kind of like circle, you know, snake eating its tail there. And it's hard to unironically like something that's trying to do that. It's a strange chemistry, I think.
Like, this feels like the only time I'll be able to potentially talk about this documentary on this podcast. But there's a fantastic documentary called American Movie, which is about this kind of hapless fool in America who kind of has that Ed Wood approach of kind of pressing upon family members. Like in this, I think it's his uncle or his like granddad. He's like really puts upon him to kind of like juice him for money and stuff like that. And there's a perfect thing. The film he's making is called Coven, but he refuses to call it Coven. He's like, oh man, Coven sounds like oven. It's called Coven. And so like, and that is so fascinating because, like Ed Wood, it's this thing of like he thinks he is making high art. He thinks he is the Orson Welles of his day, and it's a recommend for yourself. And if anyone listening hasn't seen it, it's a fantastic watch. And it feels perfect to shout out on a kind of
That always comes up as one of those great docs, and it's one I haven't seen. And seeing as how much I love stories about people making movies and trying to be creative, I definitely need to check that out.
So, talking about people who make movies, let's get into how you became aware of the Coppola family as an entity, as this kind of spider's web of a crazy extended family that they are.
Yeah, well, for me, you know, a lot of my film sort of education and formative years, as they were, was in school, where I met Paul Wilson Morris, who's one of my Spotlight co-hosts, very, very good friend of mine since way back then. And he was kind of like this walking library. And, you know, he was Wikipedia on legs before there was Wikipedia when it came to movies. And he was an early adopter of DVD. I remember some of his earliest, you know, DVD shelves back in like 2001 being quite full already. So he kind of became my one-stop shop for like rentals, basically, to the point where at one point he did have a printed Excel sheet of everything he owned so he could keep track of what was going in and out. So pretty much of any type of film, it comes back to him in one way or another. So with the Coppolas, you know, I would have probably borrowed that Godfather trilogy set off him, which would have been maybe my first exposure, if not that or Apocalypse Now, because they were definitely, you know, the big quote-unquote greatest films ever that you see sort of in your student years if you're studying film for sure. So this was kind of just before our college years, but I remember doing Godfather pretty early. And I've done them again since, but I think it has actually been a while since I've rewatched them. So, you know, a proper Godfather rewatch is definitely on the cards.
So when did you kind of become aware that there was more of them apart from Francis Ford Coppola?
I think it's probably like a steady stream, because as you say, this family tree is so kind of vast. I think, you know, realizing Nicolas Cage is in there is like one of the early ones, and then Talia Shire, and then through to Jason Schwartzman, and before you know it, as you've obviously been uncovering, you know, you can there's a 6 degrees of separation between any film and a Coppola if you look hard enough. So yeah, I think around about the time, you know, my film kind of exposure was expanding out and seeing films with these people in or made by these people, it was like, oh, it all kind of comes back to them. Sofia Coppola as well, definitely, as an actual filmmaker as well. So probably her being the big one, really. Because I think around the time Lost in Translation came out was when that was slap bang in the middle of college for me. So that would have been like, oh, what's this? Oh, yeah, she did Virgin Suicides and she's a Coppola. And yeah, I think between her and Schwartzman, for sure, is when the web kind of revealed itself.
What's been the kind of like biggest, like, really? They have a kind of link to the family, or like, I don't know, like, yeah, is there one that you kind of go, how are they connected to the family?
I think for a while it might have been Talia Shire, because I definitely knew her through the Rockies, of course, as Adrian. Mm-hmm. And I probably knew her as Adrian way, way longer before I realized, you know, how she was connected, or even that she was Jason Schwartzman's mum, because that's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
My Rocky knowledge came first before that, in that case. And then seeing things like all the various people who collaborate through Wes Anderson, along with Jason Schwartzman, that are all connected. Roman Coppola as well, for sure.
Yeah. Well, today, obviously, we're here to talk about Stephanie Schwartzman's involvement.
Yeah, one of the lesser known ones, for sure.
Ed Wood, who kind of has this kind of small but perfectly formed little filmography that she kind of worked in for the main part, like the art department, well, all of it, kind of the art department, whether it's a set dresser or a lot of time it's art department coordinator or assistant to the production designer and stuff like that. So from that list, what would have been the first film that Stephanie Schwartzman had worked on that you would have seen?
Probably Ed Wood, right? Because Edward Scissorhands, the other Ed Wood. yeah, because these kind of early Burton ones, these kind of early 90s films, I can't quite remember which order I saw them in. I mean, Ed Wood, as we'll get to, was one of the earliest as well, but Edward Scissorhands, I'm sure, maybe came a bit sooner. So seeing her work on there, I would say, is the one.
It's a perfect film to kind of be an entry point as well, because there's so many in Tim Burton's life. There's this nice kind of crossover between him and Ed Wood in the fact that that's one of the last films that Vincent Price would have been in, right? Edward Scissorhands. And there's this kind of beautiful symmetry between how he had taken, yeah, Vincent Price out of like kind of later obscurity and put him in a film, as Ed Wood did with Bela Lugosi.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Ed Wood. But before we do that, let's listen to the trailer.
Tim Burton, director of Batman, Beetlejuice, and Edward Scissorhands, now takes you to a completely different world. The true story of a Hollywood legend, Ed Wood.
And action!
He made movies like no one else.
You want to keep moving? Got to get through that door.
Cut! That was perfect.
Perfect. Do you know anything about film production?
Well, I like to think so.
He had an eye for talent.
I met Bela Lugosi.
Well, I thought he was dead.
This is the most uncomfortable coffin I've ever been in.
No, he's very much alive.
You flying saucer?
He had a passion for storytelling.
Get me transvestites. I need transvestites.
You're flashy. They want that. Okay. But they want professionalism. So Nick Sonnenelli, without losing naivete.
What kind of a movie is this?
It's science fiction. A heartbreaking romance.
Brave robbers from outer space.
Brave robbers from what?
And he had a secret he couldn't hide.
I like to dress in women's clothing. Panties, sweaters, pumps. It's just something I do.
You don't like sex with girls?
No, I love sex with girls. Wearing their clothes makes me feel closer to them.
How can you act so casual when you're dressed like that?
All right, everybody, let's finish this picture.
Touchstone Pictures presents Johnny Depp, Martin Landau, Sarah Jessica Parker, Patricia Arquette, and Bill Murray in the true story.
Give me a hand. Brolin.
Of an unforgettable filmmaker.
We're making another movie. I got the Church of Beverly Hills to put up the cash.
How do you get all your friends to get baptized just so you can make a monster movie?
And his legacy that will live forever.
How do you burn this up?
Shake his legs around. Looks like he's killing me. This is the one.
Step on in! I command you!
This is the one I'll be remembered for.
Ed Wood, a Tim Burton film.
Really? Worst film you ever saw. Well, my next one will be better. Hello?
So, obviously directed by Tim Burton, written by Scott Alexander and Larry Kowalski. I can never pronounce that name. The kind of a writing duo who, again, have like a very fascinating filmography, and that they kind of seem to have just picked these really interesting stories of real people, whether it's The People versus Larry Flint or Man on the Moon,
or Agent Cody Banks.
a real outlier in their filmography. But like, even up until recently, they did Dolomite Is My Name, right?
Yeah. So that feels like coming full circle for them, coming back to another film about, you know, trying to get a film made. But yeah, they also worked with Burton again on Big Eyes as well, which is kind of like that and Ed Wood are like his two kind of, I'd say, you know, quote unquote grounded biopic type movies as well.
So I like to always put my guests on the spot, Matt, and ask them to give us a synopsis
of
the film in question. So could you tell us what Ed Wood is about?
Well, yeah, so this is set in early 50s Hollywood, and it follows struggling director Edward Wood Jr., who is trying to get his movies made, and he just has an unrelenting optimism and enthusiasm for filmmaking and getting his stuff out there, which slowly kind of gets beaten down out of him throughout the course of the film. And the film is very much mainly about him kind of, you know, coming back around and realizing, you know, you got to fight for your vision, even if you don't have any talent, because yeah, that's beside the point. So it's kind of follows him as he gets a job directing a film called Glenn or Glenda, which quickly becomes a very big commercial failure. And so then he tries to independently finance his next picture, which becomes Bride of the Atom, later renamed Bride of the Monster. And it's mostly kind of about him and his relationship with aging golden, you know, classic Hollywood star Bela Lugosi, and how the two of them kind of help each other out. And in a way, it's almost like a warped Star Is Born kind of, where, you know, it's about this, you know, a has been on his way out, meeting an up and comer with no real talent. So and their paths crossing as they do. But, you know, it's a film about people and relationships and being true to yourself, and, you know, not letting reality beat you down. And, you know, a lot of really inspiring kind of themes here, all wrapped up in this, you know, gorgeous, you know, black and white movie biopic about this real guy.
Amazing. That is a perfect synopsis for this. So let's kind of start off with talking about the cast of this. So obviously we have Johnny Depp. I'm not sure if we can praise him or we have to lambast him, but obviously I like to look at this film kind of at the time when he was very much still up and coming and seemed like he had the whole world ahead of him.
he's a tricky guy, obviously, and, you know, for all his controversies, I find him that he's at his best when he's playing weird, almost like a weirdo stand-in for Burton himself in the best of his Burton roles, especially. But here, you know, he's very wide-eyed. He's got that kind of goofy, toothy grin, like this light voice, a manic physicality. It's a whole kind of body performance. And I think he's really wonderful here. This is definitely one of his best roles. And completely the opposite, of course, to Edward Scissorhands, which was mostly, you know, mute and very caged in and restricted, you know.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, obviously, Martin Landau. So before we talk about Martin Landau, I've got this great clip of the real Dolores Fuller talking about Bela Lugosi and Martin Landau's portrayal of him.
Eddie was not always that up. He had his heartbreaks too. It was a little Andy Hardy, but oh, what a great actor he is. And I just loved the portrayal. He captured a great deal of Eddie's personality.
Martin Landau, how about him playing Bela Lugosi?
He was magnificent. He was just, at times, you could just see Glenn or Glenda, and it was almost like Bela was there. Of course, Bela never used all the foul language that was written into the script to make it more interesting for today's market. But he did a wonderful job, and of course won an Academy Award.
So, yeah, that is the fantastic Dolores Fuller talking about Martin Landau. And so let's talk about this kind of performance we get from Martin Landau. Obviously won him the Academy Award in 1995. So, yeah, before I'd like to kind of delve in to see if that was a worthy win. But what do you make of Martin Landau's performance in this film?
Oh, yeah, he's great. I mean, this is pure, you know, really juicy support, you know, classic supporting actor part here. Playing, you know, such a iconic guy, but in a sort of period of his life that we might not have seen a lot of him in. And it definitely kind of is one of those, it's quite a well-trodden kind of trope these days, because there's been a sort of slew of these films about sort of classic Hollywood stars at the end of their life. So you've got stuff like Stan and Ollie, and Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, and Judy as well. And I think the thing all of those have in common is, you know, these great central performances, but it's also about kind of washed up Hollywood stars basically going to England and having a last shot at fame through the stage life. So it's not quite as far as that. But I think even someone like Lugosi did something similar as well. Like, you know, I think, you know, he mentions a lot of stage productions in here, and I think he did do some stuff in England as well. So it feels like at the time, this was kind of what, you know, washed up stars kind of did. But he's great here. Like he has chances to go full Dracula, because it feels like that was very much in Lugosi's personality. Whether it's scaring kids on Halloween or, like, you know, trying out for coffins and stuff. So it's very much that role is clearly a part of him. But he brings such a warm humanity to this as well, in amongst all the pull the strings.
When I was pulling clips for this film, like, it was kind of the Bela Lugosi moments that Martin Landau has that kind of jumped out to me. There's a mixture of, like, absolute pathos,
yeah,
that Martin Landau like managed to deliver, like when he first meets Ed Wood and kind of talks to him about like why horror doesn't work now, and the kind of like it doesn't have the romance or the sexy nature of it, and then like kind of juxtaposed to this kind of like really like living the legend and dirty old man we get when he sees a vampire on TV.
Yeah.
Which is just like, yeah, I love that moment.
Yeah, and it's a tricky part to play, because I think, as Landau said, you know, Lugosi was this very theatrical guy. So if you try and, you know, ape that too much, then you might look like your performance is chewing the scenery. So he had to kind of make it so that it was the character's theatricality, not his own, which has got to be something really hard to do, where it's like, as a performer, like, you know, am I being theatrical and chewing the scenery, or am I playing somebody who kind of does that naturally? And but the film gives him plenty of time to play all these parts of Lugosi, as we've said, you know, the quieter, more depressed side, the theatrical when he's not on camera, the theatrical when he is on camera. And you know, he imbues this guy with someone who has lived this life and has seen the ups and downs, and you know, he's still bitter about his rivalry with Karloff and all this kind of stuff.
I've got a clip of that I just want to play, because I think it's a real standout moment for me in the film.
You know which movie of yours I love, Mr. Lugosi? The Invisible Ray. You were great as Karloff's sidekick.
Karloff? Sidekick? Fuck you! Karloff does not deserve to smell my shit! That limey cocksucker can rot in hell for all I care!
What happened?
How dare that asshole bring up Karloff? You think it takes talent to play Frankenstein? It's all makeup and grunting.
Bella, I agree 100%.
Now, Dracula, that's a role that requires talent.
Of course! Dracula requires presence. It's all in the eyes and the voice and the hand.
That's right. That's right. You seem a little agitated. You want to go outside and get some air?
Bullshit! I'm ready now. Roll the camera!
What's really interesting about that, I find, is how it's juxtaposed with a scene that is later on in the film and kind of Bella is a lot more frail and is just about to record that scene where he's like attacked by the octopus.
Yeah.
And then has this deep regret that he never got to play Frankenstein and kind of just has this monologue out of nowhere where he beautifully kind of says, like, I had a chance to play it and I thought it was beneath me. And I think it's a really good portrayal in this film of that kind of, it doesn't matter if you're an actor or whatever you do, just that thing, that feeling of getting older and feeling relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And like I just wanted to play this moment that kind of really captures that in a nutshell of what it feels like to get that old and kind of feel like I just want, I don't know, a sliver of relevance again.
Bella, what happened?
Andy, why did you chase them? After all these years, the press is finally interested again in Bela Lugosi.
Bela, those people are parasites. They just want to exploit you.
Fine. Let them. There is no such thing as bad press, Andy. Man from New York even said he's putting me on the front page. First celebrity ever to check into a rehab. When I get out of here, I will be healthy.
So what do you kind of like make of that aspect of the film, that kind of quite a weighty subject that it deals with?
Yeah, no, I really love that. I'm a real sucker for stories kind of about really stubborn people reaching a certain point in their life, whether when they're older or just something happens, when they suddenly, you know, are overcome with regret for having not done things differently. You know, I think it's one of the biggest kind of universal themes is personal regrets and things we wish we could have done differently and wish we could turn back the clock. And I think films about actors in this way can do it in a really interesting way, where like on the one side, you know, it's not that big an important thing in all of life, you know, whether somebody had a certain role in a film, you know. But on the other side, films are so meaningful to so many people. I imagine if you're someone who has regrets about the roles you've picked or the decisions you've made, you might, you know, start spiraling of like, what could I have brought to people? What could I have brought to the industry and the audience? And how many more different lives could I have touched? And it's interesting to hear that kind of stuff coming from someone like Lugosi and, you know, having rivalries with somebody who was operating very much in the same space as him, in the same kind of horror movies of the 30s and things. And it's, I love that clip as well, because, you know, we hear Ed say, you know, most people are parasites, they just want to exploit you. Because for all of his kind of wide-eyed optimism in this film, you know, he's not entirely naive. Like, he gets it. You know, that line comes from Ed himself, showing that he's aware of the system he's playing, you know. And he's not just someone who's barreling blindly forward with this kind of very childish idea of how the world works. Like, he often acts like that, but in moments like that where he kind of comes through really clear, he shows that deep down he does kind of know what's going on, how to play it. And similarly, early on when he's phoning up the producer to try and get the gig early on, he's, you know, Dolores says, Eddie, I don't understand, why are you the most qualified director? And he says, oh, it's just hogwash, hun, I had to get in the door somehow. And like, you know, yeah, he knows, you know, just say what you gotta say. It's a fake it till you make it movie. And I think those kind of themes really, really speak to me, because, you know, I'm trying to be creative myself, and I'm always been trying to, you know, push like a kind of screenwriting career and filmmaking career. And you're continuously questioning, like, are you any good? Have you had, you know, have you blown opportunities? Have you missed opportunities? And I think seeing someone like Ed just kind of do what needs to be done to get in the door, and then, you know, throughout the film, he kind of gets beaten down and beaten down to the point where, you know, he's battling those producers at the end. And it all swings around with that meeting with Orson Welles. And it's like, yeah, you know, your vision is worth fighting for because it's yours. And yeah, I think it takes an enormous degree of self confidence to do that. And I think that's what we're all looking for, really.
There's a great moment that really captures kind of Eddie's spirit in the way that he kind of is happy to, well, for him, he doesn't see people on their downward trajectory. He just, like, I don't know, there could obviously be an argument of like the exploitative nature of that, because obviously the people he kind of surrounds himself with, whether it's like Vampira or Tor Johnson or Bela Lugosi himself, that they are people who are on the downward slope of their career, and he kind of swoops in and gets them in his film. But this I think perfectly is delivered by Patricia Arquette's character Kathy O'Hara, kind of really sums up kind of the sweetness of Eddie.
You should feel lucky. Eddie's the only fella in town who doesn't pass judgment on people.
That's right. If I did, I wouldn't have any friends.
So, like,
yeah, I was just about to quote that line for that bit. That's it.
it is that kind of, like, he just sees people as, yeah, as much as there is like an opportunistic nature to him, but like at the same time, it's heartwarming that he takes on these people who are somewhat, I don't know, like the misfits of filmmaking, and like they get to make these somewhat fascinating films. Like, I hold my hands up, I probably should have, but I've never seen an Ed Wood film, and it's kind of like, it's there on my list. I'm kind of waiting for a screening somewhere. Do you know what I mean? Planet Nine Out of Space feels like needs to be seen on the big screen.
Well, that's it. I feel like, you know, if you find your tribe, as they say, and find your people, like people who, if they're not, you know, as like-minded as you, like they're people you can work with and you enjoy being around, I think it makes the whole thing so much easier. And yeah, I think I've only seen Plan 9. I did watch it, I think, not long after an earlier rewatch of this. And yeah, the recreations of it later in the, you know, the third act of this film really hit the nail on the head. And yeah, it is hilariously bad, but very charmingly so. That's it. Like, charm is a hard thing to fake or, you know, create in films. I think people can smell cynicism a mile away, you know, as I kind of touched on, and it's definitely full of charm, that film.
We do get elements to see that Eddie is manipulative and can be quite conniving at times. I think there's like the kind of interactions he has with Juliet Landau's Loretta King, and the kind of the way he will bend to other people's wills just to get his film made, where he kind of like trying to offer her a small part in a film because he kind of gets a glimpse that she may have money, and then before he knows it, like, she's starring in picture,
and Dolores is just hurling plates at him. this was my part.
So Dolores, obviously played by Sarah Jessica Parker, what do you make of her performance in this film?
She's great. I think Sarah Jessica Parker had a really interesting run through the late 80s and early 90s. Because I think once Sex and the City kind of made it big, people forgot that she was in so much good stuff. And, you know, things like Honeymoon Vegas with Kate, and, like, you know, and Hocus Pocus, of course, and, you know, mileage will vary on a lot of these projects, but they're very good performances from her in all of these. Through, you know, To Here and then Mars Attacks with Tim Burton again and a couple years after. I think she was a really, you know, interesting actor back then, especially. And I wish, you know, more people had kind of taken her on in stranger kind of parts. Because, once I think Sex and the City kind of made it big, she was very much seen as kind of, you know, like a sort of rom-com kind of lead, which was a lot of her movies after Sex and the City. But yeah, I think she's a great like character actor, and she fits in great with this kind of, you know, misfitty cast.
I've always been interested to kind of know if this is the film that stemmed the playground insult of Sarah Jessica Parker that she has a horse face, because we get in that kind of opening scene when Ed's play has performed and the review says like she's got a horse face. And I like, from what I remember, it's definitely a joke on Family Guy or something like that. It feels like I definitely should have pulled a clip. Yeah. Found that as a clip.
It came up somewhere, yeah. And similar joke as well, because I've been rewatching a lot of Scrubs recently because of the Fake Doctors Real Friends rewatch podcast, which is very fun with Zach and Donald. And one of the big kind of jokes in an episode of that is JD writing a script called Dr. Acula. And they're talking about it on the podcast as if it's this, like, you know, hilariously unique Scrubs gag. And then, you know, seeing it literally in Ed Wood with in one of his kind of failed pitches, just like, Dr. Acula.
Yeah.
Get it?
That's perfect. I've got some bad news about Sarah Jessica Parker, though. Again, let's go to Dolores Fuller to kind of get her opinions on Sarah Jessica Parker.
That was the only thing I didn't like about the Ed Wood movie. Sarah Jessica Parker smoked all the time, and I never would smoke. And she didn't contact me. Here she's playing my life, and she didn't bother to do any research. And when she was asked on the David Letterman show by David Letterman, well, what's Dolores like? Is she still alive? What did she do with her life? She turned her head because she didn't want to give me any airtime. She says, I'm going home and have a ground glass cocktail. You know, just ornery.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, yeah, like we can understand maybe why Kim Cattrall has not come back for the new season of Sex and the City.
No research.
Yeah, if that yeah.
It's gonna be so hard to play a real life person who's still around and to hear them kind of criticize you. And yeah, you know, I'm sure there's like a million decisions going on. Like, you know, maybe the smoking was just part of the 50s Hollywood aesthetic. You never know. But yeah, if she did kind of skimp on the research and knowing that the real person's still about. But, you know, it takes a village to make a film, and there might have been a very specific kind of semi, because there's obviously semi-fictionalized elements to most people in films like these. That's got to be tough.
Yeah, she's, she actually talked about the time like she met her as well. And it was kind of like, again, like another disparaging moment of like, this isn't the Sarah Jessica Parker bashing podcast. Just that I kind of wanted to, I don't know, like it feels like a film where it's like, oh, they're no longer cool to talk about. They're no longer cool to talk about. I'm not trying to do that. This isn't a cancel hour with Petra Spazilis.
Well, yeah. Well, I was trying to think, like, is there someone else who's been publicly lambasted by the real life counterpart that they've played? Someone who's just like, I absolutely hated what they did with this. Like, I'm sure there's some examples, yeah, actually.
Yeah, there's definitely. To kind of keep it in the world of the Coppola family, I know that the real life Jean LaRoche does not like the portrayal of him by Christopher Cooper in Adaptation, which I don't understand. That's like an Oscar winning or at least Oscar nominated performance. I think it's Oscar winning performance by Chris Cooper, like as John LaRoche. But yeah, he's kind of, that's not like, but I think that stems back to the book itself as well. Like, that's not me. Like, I'm not as bad as it portrays me to be.
Well, we were saying about, you know, Landau winning the Oscar. I'm just looking at the other nominees that year, as we were saying, and the one that stands out is obviously Sam Jackson as Jules in Pulp Fiction, which, you know, none more iconic than that, really. But then Chaz Palminteri for Bullets Over Broadway, Paul Scofield for Quiz Show, and Gary Sinise for Forrest Gump. I mean, Gary Sinise is very good in Forrest Gump, but I'm happy with Landau winning that year for sure, because, you know, Jackson is he's kind of like Cage, isn't he, where he's in a hell of a lot of stuff. But he's always given it 100%, and when he's good, he's great. And if you can easily grab about 20 out of his 100 credits that are like 5-star films or performances.
I think it's the thing with Sam Jackson. I've heard it kind of talked about on other podcasts, whether it's like the rewatchables or like The Big Picture. They've kind of like talked about the idea of, is that the, like, looking through his whole filmography, is that the one he deserved it for? It's like that kind of Martin Scorsese thing where it's like, he should have won for like Goodfellas or Raging Bull.
Yeah. Is he going to end up with basically a, you know, a a Lifetime Achievement Award, but for, you know, an actual role, when it's like, oh, this is his one for such and such.
Or is he going to kind of get like, I don't know, Black Smoke, Black Snake Moan, like wins him an Academy Award because they messed up all those years ago. So kind of looking further down the cast list as well, it kind of feels like there's a couple of other people we kind of really need to shine a light on. One of them is Patricia Arquette, who is in this film for...
I always forget she's in it every time I watch.
Yeah, she kind of has this, I don't know, turns up in like the last 45 minutes, but leaves like a really beautiful impact on it. What do you make of the way that she kind of plays Captain O'Hara?
It's lovely. She's so effortlessly kind of sweet in this. And their first date on the ghost train at the fun fair is fantastic. You can see Edward, you know, building up to try and tell her, you know, his secret, like straight away, that he likes to dress up in women's clothes. And she immediately is kind of just like, cool. And from that moment on, you know, they're gonna get each other. And she's just a wonderful support for him throughout the rest of the film and the rest of his life, by the sounds of it. In a way where, you know, there isn't the extra baggage of her also being an actress and wanting a part like Dolores was. And I think it's once she shows up on the scene that kind of gives Ed the kind of strength to really push forward as well.
I missed all of that. The internet went a bit funny. I do apologise, Matt.
All good.
What was it you said? Like the internet like messed up and I didn't hear a word of that.
Oh, just that she's really sweet and a real great support for Ed from that point on, and she's not burdened by, you know, wanting a role like Sarah Jessica Parker was, Dolores was, and the moment, you know, she accepts him as who he is, which is very early on, you can tell that he's going to have the strength to kind of push through the rest of the story.
Yeah, I love the moment that they meet, like when they kind of in that. In the waiting room of the hospital that Bella's been committed to.
I'm a director, writer, actor, and producer.
Ah, come on. Nobody does all that.
Oh, yes, they do. Two people. Orson Welles and me.
Wow.
What you making?
Booties for my father. Gets cold in the hospital.
Has he been here long?
This is my 13th pair.
Excuse me.
So, I think like that it's just this kind of, I think it's what makes Patricia Arquette so like magnetic to watch is this. She can deliver these very, well, in the 90s especially, she either delivers these very sweet and kind of like airy performances, or she was kind of like amazing at like screaming a lot of the time and like frantic. It's kind of like, one end or the other. I guess that's why her and Cage might have made like the perfect couple, right?
She can really sell lines like, I'm making booties for my father. Just like, that's the most innocent kind of introduction ever, like making little booties for my sick dad in hospital.
And there's that whole element as well that obviously like her and Dolores Fuller, like the characters, look very, very similar. Like, I'm not sure, like, I'm almost like not sure what like that Tim Burton is trying to tell us with that, whether it's just like a kind of Edward has very much got a type, or if it's like a thing of like they actually did just look similar.
It's very, very interesting. And I mean, they're great, and it's interesting that, you know, Arquette and Sarah Jessica Parker don't really share any scenes as well. It's kind of like once one's out, one's in. And it really is like the polar opposite of what he needs and who she is as well.
Mm-hmm. And the final person really to kind of talk about on this cast list is the one and only Bill Murray.
Mr. Bunny, Vlad Roth, I heard you were becoming a lady.
Oh, that? Mexico was a nightmare. We got in a car accident. He was killed. Our luggage was stolen. The surgeon turned out to be a quack. If it hadn't been for these men, I don't know how I would have survived.
So Bill Murray is kind of, he seems to be the only one who is playing this like a broad comedy. Is that a fair assessment?
We'll say again, you went a bit slow there.
No worries. I think it, Bill Murray seems to be now, the only one who's playing this like a broad comedy. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yeah, he's given it all his Bill Murray. And I think he must really love these kind of parts where he can kind of sink into an ensemble a bit. And I think in some, you know, Wes Anderson films, he obviously gets a bit of this as well, where he can just rock up and be an element, you know, a version of Bill Murray as we kind of know and love him in a film, while still, you know, playing a very specific character, very specific, you know, real person. And it's great to see him kind of in this period, like, you know, acting alongside Depp. And, you know, I'd love to see Bill Murray in another Tim Burton film, because, you know, Burton's definitely known for reusing actors and especially certain people within certain periods. So this was kind of beginning the period of him and Sarah Jessica Parker with Mars Attacks as well, and Lisa Marie, all the way through to Planet of the Apes. And yeah, I'm trying to picture Bill Murray in some of his other current films, which is tough to do. But yeah, I'd love him to re-team again now.
Well, it very much feels like a kind of down period of Bill Murray's career somewhat. Do you know what I mean? Like, kind of, I don't know, the 90s is quite a interesting one. Obviously, like, 93 he had Groundhog Day, but kind of like, before then, do you know what I mean? Like, he's doing these films that, I don't know, and would go on to
I think mid-90s for him. Yeah, you're right. I think 93 Groundhog Day is a huge hit. And then if you count, you know, getting back around to Rushmore in 98 as not necessarily a big hit, of course, but, you know, a big part for him and a great film. So the rest of that mid-90s period is tricky to kind of think of for Murray, because it's, yeah, coming right after the kind of crescendo of that great run from the mid-80s through to early 90s.
Bill Murray's character, so Bunny Beckinridge, feels like a perfect jumping-off point to talk about one of the issues that this film tackles really well, and that is of, like, transvesticism and, like, transgender issues as well. And it feels like not just in the aspect of the time period in which it was made, but the time period it was set, feels very like a very progressive film, right?
Yeah, well, it's obviously, you know, these things were obviously, you know, big back then, big now, and in the 90s. So, you know, it's a 90s made film about a 50s era, and it does feel very kind of like accepting and upfront about a lot of this, because you can definitely picture a version of this film that maybe focuses more on Ed's alcoholism, which is basically completely excised here, and kind of hide more of that element of his life, of his character. But I'm glad they kind of highlight it here. And yeah, you do get various shades of everything here, with him admittedly being like a transvestite and liking to dress up, and Bill Murray being the one wanting to have the sex change. And I think it doesn't, I'm probably not the one to say really, but it's, you know, I don't think it goes too hard on highlighting these kind of people as like the outsiders or othering, because everyone involved here is kind of within this group of, you know, quote unquote weirdos that Ed surrounds himself by. So there's a lot of acceptance in the film. And I think it's quite telling, you know, that Dolores at one point is like the only one who seems to have like an issue with it, as he points out on set. And it's so great to see Depp really kind of revel in Edward's moments where he feels most comfortable dressing up, like when he's getting stressed out trying to make Plan 9, and he comes back out in the women's clothes, and it's great.
Yeah, and I think like there's that moment when Dolores like finally decides to leave Ed, and it's kind of like, I only stuck about with you for the picture, and now it's over. And it's like, and obviously he's kind of like surprised the cast and crew by dancing as like a kind of belly dancer and stuff like that. And it's,
yeah,
I think that's a perfect moment of encapsulating kind of how accepting this group of people are, that they are this band of misfits and stuff like that. And the fact that it seems like the one person who is against the kind of him cross-dressing or kind of the idea of the other is Dolores Fuller. So she's kind of like very much like, if there is a villain to this piece, it is kind of her to some degree. Like, not that this film really like deals with like good guys and bad guys. It's kind of just like, here's what happened to some degree.
Yes. I think it explicitly makes Dolores the outsider of that group, you know, for her lack of like empathy and acceptance there. You know, she starts out being kind of his only person, really. And then as it goes on, he surrounds himself more and more with this team. And, you know, you've got like Vampire on TV and Lugosi, this weird old horror guy, and this like, you know, big wrestler and Bill Murray and everybody else there. And I think Dolores slowly realizes that, you know, she's the outsider here and she doesn't fit in. I think that makes it easier for her to sort of leave him. But yeah, it's an interesting switch going from her being his kind of main rock at the start to being someone who, you know, maybe never really knew him at all, or at the very least, you know, doesn't accept him and wants him to change. And as we've said, you know, so much of this film is about accepting who you are and being proud of who you are, and you know, pursuing what you want to pursue. And so, you know, if you're not with someone, you're against them. And even though she does get the short stick for sure when she gets bumped off that lead role and has to just slum it as the file clerk, you know, she starts to become, you know, a bit nasty with it all. And yeah, some of her and Juliet Landau's barbs are very funny.
So, is there any particular scenes that like really stick out to you that you kind of feel like we should chew over and like, I don't know, yeah, get the meat off the bones of?
I think definitely the Orson Welles encounter, mm-hmm. which is kind of the crux of the whole thing. You know, he's in the middle of making the film, which is the one he'll be remembered for, as he points out. And you know, it's surprising to see, because you could easily probably do an Ed Wood film that's all about the making of Plan 9, but that only really comes in the last kind of 30-40 minutes, and it, you know, it finds him at his kind of lowest ebb. And I love the idea, because, you know, this was a fictionalized invention of these two meeting, of, you know, the worst director in the world meeting the best director in the world and immediately just having common ground. And, you know, he's surprised to hear that even Orson Welles has to deal with producer notes and people wanting different cuts. And, you know, when he points out, you know, a vision is worth kind of fighting for, yeah, what does he say? Yeah, is it all worth it? It is when it works.
Yeah.
It just kind of sums it up perfectly. And it's showing that, you know, the end quality, the end result of something is kind of beside the point when you're the creative making something at a point when that's still in flux. You can have somebody like, you know, the great Orson Welles chat to the derided Ed Wood, and they're on, you know, they're equals, they're on the same page. And I think it's a great kind of... it's almost like a deus ex machina for the film to be like, okay, Ed's, you know, spiraling, he's in trouble. Let's just quickly have him run to a bar, meet Orson Welles and get re-inspired and go back and finish the film. But it's a testament to the film that it works so well. And Vincent D'Onofrio is so great in that little cameo with Maurice LaMarche dubbed in as Orson, who, yeah, is forever the greatest Orson voice. His recreations of his frozen peas and drunk wine adverts are incredible to behold.
that scene holds possibly like what, or like the key to the whole thing. And like the fact that Orson Welles mentions Don Quixote, and like both of them feel like these Don Quixote characters chasing after these windmills of success, whatever that may be, whether it's like Orson Welles trying to follow up the early success of Citizen Kane, or just kind of Ed Wood trying to get a success entirely. And it's kind of like, I like that on rewatch, like you get that kind of, and I don't know, it is that kind of thing where you're like, I know who Don Quixote is, like, oh, that's a nice little layer to it. But like, yeah, I think that scene, very much like you stated, kind of, it's totally picked out of the air, but like I think it makes the film so beautiful for that scene to like kind of I don't know, tell us, and that's what they're all after, they're, and we're all the bloody same.
And I think that's what makes Burton such a great match for this, because, you know, he really needed to be the one to make this, as, you know, he was a Wood fan. Well, you know, he understood where he was coming from. You know, he had the same relationship with Vincent Price as he had with Lugosi. And I feel like other people making this film could have easily highlighted more of how shit Ed Wood was as a filmmaker. Whereas here, Burton has real empathy for this creative who just wants to create. And I think that also well seen goes a long way to kind of proving that, because, you know, writing it a different way, you could have him walk in and make it be more mean, or Wells could have been someone who, you know, you do more to highlight the fact that he's the greatest director. Yeah. Edward's the worst, and Orson could be more antagonistic or deriding him, and it could have gone another way, you know, where Edward getting to meet his hero essentially and getting sort of slammed for it and ridiculed and humiliated could have pushed him back into finishing the film out of spite, you know. But by having it this way and having Wells immediately, you know, he doesn't know who he is or anything, but he's immediately just, he senses another, you know, a like-minded filmmaker, and they can relate ever so briefly on the commonalities of the difficulties of making film, because it is hard no matter who you are. And, you know, and I love these type of films, as I think I said, you know, about movie making, because so much of them are about, like, the underdog. Films like The Disaster Artist and Bowfinger and Dolomite Is My Name, as we've said, and also Brigsby Bear, great indie from a few years ago, kind of about, you know, the joys of creating with friends and the importance of storytelling. And I just see a lot of myself in a lot of the characters in these films, of just trying, you know, striving to do something that ultimately might not even be that important or worthy of your time and money for everyone involved doing it, but seeing like a vision through. And it's funny because, yeah, filmmaking's tough. So, like, you know, a few of brief stories of my own, you know, I made a bunch of, you know, short films when I was a teen, back with Liam and Paul from Spotlight. And, you know, seeing Ed Wood in these films, you know, run away because they don't have permits and that. So, and like, or doing one take and just having to leg it, like, rings so true. Because, yeah, some of the films we made as teens, I remember we were making a film in the center of Bournemouth, and it was meant to be sort of like the end of the world with nobody about. So we'd pulled an all-nighter and we went down into Bournemouth Town Square at like 3 a.m. on a July Sunday. So the sun was up or coming up and there was nobody about. We were getting all these amazing shots, and then this like police car kind of rolls around and we've got Liam like with a baseball bat like stuck in, Paul stuck in a shopping trolley that we're using as a dolly. And just running around trying to get what we can. And then... Still there?
The internet fucked up. I missed all of that. Obviously, I will hear it in.
That's
the...
right. I'll just carry on. and then recently. So this is, you know, just to highlight how tricky this all is. I've been trying to make a little short film this summer. It's like 2 minutes long. I've scaled it back as much as I can, so it has a crew of two, me and the camera guy, editor, everything else, and a cast of two. I was like, right, four people, I can do this, it's great. But it's a little comedy set in like a park in summer, so needed good weather. Obviously, we've had the worst summer ever for weather, so that was one thing. And then one thing after another just kept happening with like schedules, and we got like a shoot date down, which was like randomly this Thursday that did have good weather, and either side of it was rain. But on the morning of, like, we had, you know, someone had to pull out for personal reasons and things, and it was stressful. And like, to this time of recording, I've been trying to get this one little film done, and we're having to push again and again for sometime in the middle of September. So I'm hoping we get like a Indian summer heat wave to help us through, but this is just a perfect example of how hard it is and how much you need everybody to want it as much as you do to be free, especially if, you know, it's so small you're not paying anyone, of course. And, you know, yeah, no matter how small something is, everyone needs to have at least some of your passion. And yeah, I hope I can get this done still. I have my fingers crossed.
it's definitely that thing of, I don't know, like everyone like coming together. And it's very much, again, to link it back to what I said about Frank Henenlotter, like, looking at brain damage, they kind of have that thing of like, someone says like low budget stuff's not made by committee. Almost, there's almost got to be like this driving visionary force who kind of like wants, like, need, like, knows how everything's going to work out, because otherwise you're never gonna get the film actually finished. If like you're,
yeah,
you're chatting about stuff, you've got to have that person to take charge. And I like that. I don't know. You kind of it's there's humor throughout this film in the fact that like Edward's like incompetent to some degree. Like a lot of the time, he'll be like, "They definitely need another shot." Like when it's kind of like, but he goes, "No, let's go for another." And then a kind of a gag that I love in this is when he's got the two dresses, and it very much like makes a joke at the form of the film being in black and white, and asks like one of the crew, "Which dress do you want to go for, like the blue or the green one?" And he's like, "Oh, well, I'm colorblind, so maybe the darker gray one." And it's like stuff like that that I've kind of like picked up on like this most recent watch, kind of. And I think, yeah, the film is beautifully captures that element of just trying to make stuff. And like, mm-hmm. I've done it throughout my life, like whether it's like music or whatever, even like just like kind of like going out there, give it a good old try. And like, you might, like, I don't know, like, fingers crossed in my death, people may go look back and go, "You know what? He's all right, that guy. He wasn't..."
hopefully before then.
Yeah. But like there's always a hope that you...
I mean, you know, being reminded of just how everyone's kind of in the same boat, really, with stuff. My main kind of Tim Burton story is I was an extra on Dark Shadows for a day way back when. And it was only about a year. I've been doing sort of backgrounding for like a year, or supporting artists, as they're more commonly known now. And to this day, this was the most impressive set I'd ever been on. So it was the main Heartlight 70s Boston type harbor set from Dark Shadows, mm-hmm. all built on wooden stilts in the back lot of Pinewood. And I was on there as like a replacement for some other extra. So I had to kind of get into his probably still sweaty outfit as this kind of photojournalist for the day. And fantastic. So, you know, speaking again of Stephanie Schwartzman with production design, you know, and art department stuff, you know, this was just an incredible recreation because it had like winding streets, a high street, a cinema, cars on it. And it's all just on wooden stilts, basically, all leading to the water tank where the harbor was. And I'm in this very brief scene where I'm one of a gaggle of photojournalists taking a photo of Michelle Pfeiffer as she opens up the plant, the like factory on the waterfront. And in the film itself, the shot with us in isn't even there. it's like a wide, and we're around the corner, and we can see as our flash bulbs. But I remember like being standing around at one point, and Tim Burton was there in his chair, and we just had to wait for a plane overhead to go away. And it felt like something that, you know, me, Liam, and Paul had dealt with like a lot making our little films, where it was, you know, we'd be out in a field or on a public street, we'd have to wait for a car, you know, a noisy car to stop going past, or a plane overhead for sound. And seeing, you know, Tim Burton like in this tiny area of a huge set on Pinewood having to do the exact same thing of just like hold for plane, and just kind of watching him sat there like sort of tapping his fingers for a minute, being like, "Do do do, time is money," and then like, "Okay, go." I was like, you know, filmmaking's all the same no matter what scale you're on.
So as we start to like wrap up the conversation, something you mentioned there that we should definitely mention, since it was what the Coppola connection was involved in, is the production design, the kind of and the general look of this film. What do you like? I personally think it like it looks beautiful, and that's from like Tim Burton's choice of angles, but even down to the way that the film is like. I don't know, like just the look of it. It like you feel like you're in 1950s LA, right?
Yeah, like, you know, it's a film set in 50s, sort of shot like a 50s film. You know, not least the black and white, but also the extreme kind of harsh contrast in the lighting. And I recently rewatched Batman Returns for Sun Double Deep, which was a film I'd always kind of liked. But this rewatch, maybe it was watching it on Daryl's 4K edition on his giant TV, really just brought out how fucking great a film that is, and just how good it looks. And I think, I can't remember if we say on the episode or if we were just talking to each other as we were watching it, you know, like films these days don't get this contrast of dark and light right. You either go fully natural light and then dark scenes are just pitch black, or everything's overlit or colored weird. But Batman Returns has so many scenes set in dark places, be it the Batcave or Penguin's Lair or wherever, where you can see everything, whether it's in the foreground or background. But it's clearly a dark scene, but it's just lit so well. And Ed Wood, you know, being the film he does directly afterwards, takes that kind of one step further by being fully black and white and being able to play with these shadows. And, you know, when Ed's at Lugosi's house and he's going a bit nuts and he's got like the gun in his hand and there's these kind of wild angles and it's very goes very hard on the shadows there. It just feels like this was like a dream for Burton to do. And yeah, I kind of wish he'd do something else, either set in this sort of time period or not saying to do a sequel or anything, but, you know, another film from Burton's eye about 50s Hollywood or 30s horror even, or something like that. I mean, you know, he gets kind of, he gets to be sometimes the butt of a joke of, you know, you can tell a Burton film by gnarled trees and, and shadows and Eva Green or Helena Bonham Carter being there. But, you know, the guy's got a style and it really works and when it works. And I think he's someone who's always as strong as the script and the story he's paired with. But when he's got a good one, as it is in here, he can really deliver. And I think he's someone with a true visual aesthetic and directorial style, which is, you know, semi rare these days, where more and more things are becoming slightly more homogenized.
Well, I think it's that thing, like, and some people get confused of like what a director's job is to some degree. Like, either people like kind of go in two camps, they either think that like they are this like wunderkind who has managed to just like they did it all. Do you know what I mean? Like, or like they're the people like, oh, what it like? What do they actually do? But it's this thing that they all they are is just great taste finders. Do you know what I mean? It's like the thing of managing to be able to go, this head of this department, getting these people together to kind of, and the trust in that. And I think this film really does convey that really well, because it very much feels like everyone, down to the kind of Howard Shore score that again is beautifully depicts this era and like the use of theremins and like bongos and stuff like that, very like evokes that time. Or it's like the production design and stuff like that, like the cinematography, it's like it's all like very much in keeping. And it's that thing of like Tim Burton, like I kind of like, there is a point when I think it's around Sleepy Hollow, I kind of disembark the Tim Burton train, and like, but like, this very much feels like a film where, I don't know, it feels like every department has managed to kind of click together to kind of, the vision works. It's not yet jumped into that, I don't know, CGI Burton-like aesthetic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and as much I've been saying, you know, Burton's style, obviously I do mean his team, of course, because Danny Elfman, you know, not present here, but obviously big part of his movies, and Colleen Atwood, longtime costumer, and Chris Levinson as well, longtime editor. So he's someone who, you know, has his team in place, and there's a lot of collaboration, repeat collaboration going on there, not least of all a lot of his roster of actors. But I think, you know, they're the guys that kind of, you know, bring his films to life. But I think, you know, what makes a real Burton film is his sensibility of the weirdo, of the outsider. You know, that's very much him. And I think the stories that most lean into that are the ones that often are the most successful, you know. And you got blips, depending on your opinion, on stuff like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which, you know, has Depp as this weird kind of outsider guy. On paper, it's very much a Burton kind of character, but, you know, for many reasons, that film doesn't quite hit it off. But, you know, when you've got stuff like Edward Scissorhands and this and Sleepy Hollow and Beetlejuice and his Batmans, like, there's a very, you know, clear through line between them all of the type of characters he's interested in and the stories. You know, with that Batman Returns rewatch, it's like, this is a film about three costumed freaks having a whale of a time running amok Gotham City. You know, they're doing what they love. So you love to see it.
Amazing. So let's kind of talk about how this film ends and the kind of like resolution we get. So obviously, yeah, at the end, we finally get the premiere of Plan 9 from Outer Space, and we get this beautiful shot of like the whole kind of like roster of weirdos he's assembled throughout the film. It kind of like pans down through the cinema, and you get Edward delivering, like mouthing along to the speech that like Bela Lugosi gives. And I just want to play that speech when he delivers it in the street, because it's a real high point of this film for me.
Home. I have no home. Hunted. Despised. Living like an animal. The jungle is my home. But I shall show the world that I can be its master. I shall perfect my own race of people. A race of atomic supermen that will conquer the world.
So, yeah, what do you make of the kind of like final act and the way this film wraps up?
It's really cool. Like, it feels like a lot of these films kind of end with some kind of premiere, or, you know, because The Disaster Artist kind of ends almost the same way, with the premiere of The Room and, you know, Tommy Wiseau slowly realizing that they're mocking it, and kind of how broken he is mm-hmm. with that, and how he decides in that moment to kind of accept it and pretend that's kind of what it was, which is kind of sad all in its own way. And yeah, there's a real, I think seeing people watch along to their own films and mouth along is kind of a real shorthand for showing, you know, how much they care and how much they kind of, it doesn't quite matter about the outside response. And that kind of feels like the way this one goes, with him kind of just running off right afterwards and, you know, going off to Vegas to get married to Patricia Arquette. But it's great, yeah, to see all these kind of guys lined up, and the little moments of joy, like in Tor Johnson's face of seeing his credit come up on screen. And you know, I think you feel that a lot, where it's that sense of achievement finally kind of coming in of like, oh, this is the fruit of everything. And it's kind of, and I think that's, it's been a while since I've seen it now, but I think that's kind of how Dolomite ends as well, where it's like, you know, it doesn't really matter how this is received now. We did this. Yeah. This is our victory. Like, anything else now is bonus. And that is kind of the feeling of when you finally bloody finish something and screen it for people. It's like, you know, if we can be proud of this, then that's something. And just getting here has been hard enough.
Well, there's kind of three beats throughout this film, and it kind of like they punctuate. So like, we start with a kind of premiere of a play. We kind of have that middle point, like where they go to the premiere of the, like, the sci-fi, do you know what I mean? Like the Monster of the Atom.
The Bride of the Monster?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, when he does that, and that is all, that one, like both of those first two are all about either critical reception or audience reception. Mm-hmm. So that second one, we just get the audience like kind of going fucking wild, like grabbing at Vampira, like throwing popcorn and chasing them out, like their cars getting wrecked and stuff like that. And what's beautiful about that ending for me is the fact that all that matters is those guys, like they've achieved what they wanted to achieve. Like,
Ed's done what he wanted to do, which was, you know, to turn it around through his meeting of Orson, you know, and be re-inspired to make it his way. And if you, that's the hardest thing to do, to make something your way with no compromises, because, you know, filmmaking is constant compromise and problem solving and stuff. But if you can stick to your guns in the way that matters, it kind of doesn't matter what other people think of it. And I think that's kind of the vibe Ed has at the end there, where you don't quite get a sense of whether he knows it's bad or it will go down as one of the worst films ever. But at that moment, he's like, I've done it. I've done it the way I wanted it. I can, you know, walk out of this cinema, this premiere, happy. And go straight into what I want to do next, which is, you know, getting hitched.
Perfect. So before we get out of here, is there anything I feel like we've missed when talking about this film?
I don't know. I think I wish more people checked it out. Like, I don't think it's underseen at all or underplayed. But, you know, I think in terms of Burton's filmography, you know, you might think of the Beetlejuices and Batman's first, and then maybe some of the recent, you know, misfires later. And then this one does feel like it gets semi-lost in the shuffle, when really, I think, once you ask many people who have seen all his films or is a Burton fan, it's usually unanimously top three, top five, somewhere up there. So yeah, it's a weird one to say I'd like to see get a reappraisal, because I think people know it's great. But there's not many articles being written about it. I guess we're coming up to like its 30th anniversary in a few more years, so maybe there'll be some more highlights there. I guess, yeah, it's all tricky now with everything with Depp going on. So
yeah, let's.
Yeah,
I'm sure the Guardian will have some scathing review about it.
Yeah, or maybe get pulled up on one of those like, here's this why this film you like is shit, yeah, articles, and that'll just kick off.
Amazing. So before we get into scoring this film, I always like to ask my guest if they managed to find any Coppola connections between this film, whether people who are in it or worked on it appear anywhere else in the kind of Coppola filmography.
Yeah, I've got some here that I'm sure may have popped up in other episodes, but obviously Patricia Arquette is in Ed Wood, who's married to Cage. Sarah Jessica Parker's in Honeymoon in Vegas with both Cage and The Godfather's James Caan. So this editor, yeah, Chris LeBenson, is Burton's long-term editor. He also edited Midnight Run with De Niro from Godfather 2 and Gone in 60 Seconds with Cage. And Juliet Landau was in Theodore Rex with Carol Kane, who was in Dog Day Afternoon with Pacino and John Cazale, who were both in The Godfather. So a lot of it circles around to The Godfather, basically.
Perfect. I'll rattle through a few. I've got, obviously, Bill Murray is in pretty much every Wes Anderson film. We're not going to go through them all here. Ned Bellamy, who plays Dr. Tom, who kind of fills in for Bela Lugosi, is also in Being John Malkovich and Con Air. Martin Landau himself is in Ed TV, which John Schwartzman, Stephanie's brother, was the DOP, and is in Tucker, The Man and His Dreams, which was directed by Francis Ford Coppola. G.D. Spaulding is in The Godfather Part 2 and Apocalypse Now. Vincent D'Onofrio is in Jurassic World, which I covered recently on the podcast, which again is DOP'd by John Schwartzman. And Mike Starr, the fantastic Mike Starr, who kind of plays this like no nonsense, hey, I just make crap over here, like film producer, is in New York Stories, the kind of portmanteau film that Francis Ford Coppola made with another director, and I can't actually think of the third one. I don't want to mention the other one because he's a
That guy, Mike Starr, he does great shouting down the phone with a big wagging finger energy, because he does the exact same thing 15 years later in Black Dynamite, incredible comedy. He's like, I want him dead now!
I'm pretty sure he's in Snake Eyes as well. And, like, it's on my list to rewatch, because I've been on a big De Palma like kick at the moment. But, like, I can only imagine that Mike Starr in that is, again, he's shouting at somebody.
Yeah.
that's all we've got for connections for this episode. And I always like to score films by asking what would be the perfect wine pairing for this film.
Yeah, well, so this was something I wrote down for our first take record. So let's see if I can even reread my own writing. But I'd go with the 1955 Louis M. Martini Cabernet Sauvignon Special Selection, which is a medium dark red violet colour with clarity.
Perfect.
So just keep it in the 50s.
Yeah, it feels very much like a red wine film, not just because obviously Bela Lugosi was famous for playing Count Dracula, but it's, I don't know, it manages to deal with some like really like big subjects, whether they're kind of existential subjects of being a creative, obviously subjects of, I don't know, almost like trans rights or kind of any, and like this feels like it could be an anthem, or like what would that be? Yeah, like for kind of outsiders out there, and it's very much the drum Tim Burton has been beating for most of his career.
Be like, you know, find the people who accept you, ignore the ones that don't, and be yourself. It's all positivity in this film.
Perfect. Would you say this is a bottom shelf middle shelf or top shelf wine?
Oh, this is top shelf. Perfect. Yeah. Top shelf wine, top shelf movie.
And based on this film alone, are they the greatest film family of all time?
I mean, obviously Stephanie's part here is a small one, but crucial. And the department she's in is firing on all cylinders here. So, you know, if we've only got Stephanie's talents to go by, then yeah, there's nothing they can't do.
Perfect. Which leads me perfectly onto a little section at the end where I ask some a couple of questions, which I'm glad I'm asking instead of answering. The first of which being, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the filmographies of the entire rest of the family?
It's really tough, because if we avoid kind of butterfly effect principles of erasing, somebody might erase other people anyway. I'd keep probably Jason Schwartzman, just because I really enjoy his films. Everything he does with Wes Anderson and outside of that as well, from Scott Pilgrim to Bored to Death, across film and TV. I think I can, you know, live without a couple of really, really seminal crime films, gangster films, you know, as sacrilegious as this is, to keep this quite eclectic career of a guy I just really enjoy whenever he's on screen.
Perfect. I like your selfish nature, the way you answered that question. That's what I love the most on this podcast. And you've got a wealth of stuff to get through there as well. I think, like, full-on screen time, and this sounds crazy, like, speaking about this in the same breath as Nick Cage, but, like, he is, like, Jason Schwartzman has been in the most amount of stuff, like, kind of coupled with his film output and TV, like, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Three whole seasons of a sitcom, he pops up in, a great sitcom that was kind of co-made by him, Roman Coppola, and Paul White's the director. I might be getting that wrong, but the director of Being Flynn, the Paul Dano film. So,
yeah.
So, like, yeah, there's so much to get into, and obviously, would the OC have been such a great series without that
contribution of the theme song? Yeah. He's someone who feels like he's got a lot more to give as well. And, like, you know, it feels weird saying it would be good to see him in a really dramatic part, because a lot of his stuff is dramatic and not just purely comedic. Like, his work with Alex Ross Perry is always really cool. But to see him in something semi-against type or dark or just really, or like playing a real person or something, it feels like Schwartzman is untapped in many ways as well. Because he's kind of got this youthful charm to him, and I can't quite think of any recent or what he's up to recently, you know. So I'm all up for, like, the Schwartzman comeback. Obviously, I guess he's in The French Dispatch, isn't he? Which has been delayed. But yeah, it feels like there's multiple different ways to use him in stuff that hasn't been used. Like, seeing him as the flat out villain in Scott Pilgrim was great, and it kind of tapped into his kind of like hipster cred there as well as part of that film. But yeah, it feels like you could do anything with him, and nobody really is. They're kind of using him as he has been.
I think the last thing I saw him in on the cinema, and it was a joy to see his face because it is just a talking head of him, was the Sparks Brothers, the fantastic
Edgar
Wright documentary. And I won't spoil it, but there's a great, like, kind of connection to a film that will be covered on this podcast that kind of is mentioned in that film. And I know he is going to be in a new animated film. The director's name escapes me right now, but the film's called Crypto Zoo. I think, again, recently got its, like, UK premiere at the Sundance London. But, like, again, another, like, the director also did a film with Jason Schwartzman that was called, like, My High School Is Sinking Into the Sea or something like that. So, like,
yeah, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. So I think he's got so much more to come. So that's a perfect.
Perfect. And he seems perpetually 33 years old.
Yeah.
Outside of Rushmore, it's like he's always just the same age.
Yeah.
Like, if you see him in Darjeeling Limited and something from this year, you'd be like, I don't know that 15 odd years have passed.
It's disgusting. Yeah. As I said, when I saw him in The Sparks, I was like, why do you look so fresh-faced and so beautiful? So on to the last question, which is possibly the most important question on the podcast, is what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
Take Disney to the cleaners for me.
I've been waiting for somebody to reference that. Yes, thank you. Yes, amazing. Yeah, it's that, or I've got a good lawyer if you ever may need one. Amazing. Well, Matt, thank you so much for coming and making some Coppola connections with me. Where can people find you on all the podcasts you're spread over? Where's the best place to kind of keep up to date with all of that?
Oh boy. Well, yes, you can follow me on Twitter at MattBrothers2, where I mostly tweet and retweet all three of these pods, which are Sun Double Deep, the Triple Bill title podcast, which releases weekly, where we cover three films linked by word in the title. There's Spotlight, the Star Trek podcast from a non-Trekkie perspective, where we cover all aspects of the Star Trek universe. Coming up, if not out already, there will have been an episode on Star Trek Enterprise, an episode picked out by Cam Smith from Spy Hards, flying the flag for old Enterprise there, and a sort of retrospective look at Richard Donner's film Inside Moves, because we managed to interview him in 2017, and we were very saddened by his passing, and he always wanted Inside Moves to be the film more people saw, and to this day it's nearly impossible to access and source. But we gave that a watch, finally, to try and honour him there. And it's a very good film, very good discussion as well. And then Is Paul Dano OK? is the podcast I do with Daryl Bear from Sun Double Deep, where we're going through Paul Dano, his entire filmography to see if he does get beaten up in everything he's in. And is he OK? So we will have just wrapped up our second season that releases in sort of 8 to 10 episode seasons. So we would have just finished that, looking at Prisoners with special guest Stephen Trumbull, which is obviously a big one for Is Dano OK? And then, yeah, we'll have a little hiatus. We'll cover the second half of War and Peace, the BBC miniseries he was in that break, and then come back for season 3 beginning of November. So yeah, Spotlight is kind of monthly, Sun Double Deep is weekly, and Dano drops in season. So it's a good spread of all three shows there.
Well, again, Matt, thank you so much for coming and making some Coppola connections with me.
Thank you so much for having me, man.
And there we go. We finally got there. It's been a few months in the making. If I hadn't been an idiot and audio file, we would have been A-OK. But it feels perfect. It feels very much in the of Ed that we had that kind of reshoots for the. A massive thank you again to Matt Brothers for joining me. And that is another notch on the Coppolas being the greatest film family of all time. Who would have thought it, guys? It feels like they're steaming ahead at the moment. But then again, we haven't got to any of the real bad Coppola film. As for next week on the podcast, we will be diving back into the wonderful world of Nicolas Cage and heading to Samurai Town as we look at Sion Sono's 2021. I don't even know how to describe this film, but it is Prisoners of the Ghostland, where I'll be joined by Ben Chaloner, formerly of Sudden Double Deep. He was the third wheel before Matt joined the podcast, and Ben's got some amazing stuff coming up, but he's just a fantastic guy, and he's a massive fan of Sion Sono and kind of East Asian cinema, so he's the perfect person to speak to about this. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so on Patreon or Ko-fi. There are links in the show notes. And as always, if you could leave a rating, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast, or wherever you're listening to this podcast right now, it would be greatly appreciated. I bloody love it. So as always, I've been your host, Petros Patsilivas, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember,
to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.